population density is absolutely critical to economic development. And we don't tend to think like this. And part of the reason is because for the last 250 years, we've all had this Malthusian obsession that it's going to be overpopulation that is going to bring the world to an end. You know, that we'll breed ourselves into extinction. I mean, it's turning out actually the opposite.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. My guest today is Joe Studwell, a journalist and best-selling author known for his work on East Asian economic development. His 2014 book, How Asia Works, explores the different economic and political trajectories of Asian countries after World War II, and was named by Bill Gates as one of his top five books of the year. Joe is now working on a new book asking similar questions of economic development, this time exploring how Africa works, set for release early next year. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Many years ago, I first read How Asia Works while I was in Thailand, actually shooting a photo project. In that book, you identify several major policy considerations for producing economic transformation in developing countries. And I thought we could start by recapping those key insights that you uncovered, please, if that's all right.
Yeah, I'm not sure how, well, it's certainly not original. I'm not sure how exciting the insights are, but they're always worth restating because people tend to forget quite simple things sometimes. So the first area of policy activity that I wrote about was agriculture, and agriculture is always the most important thing that governments can deal with in poor countries, developing countries, because it's what most people do. Definitionally, 75 or 80% of people in poor countries, and Asia was like this in the 50s, 60s, Africa's like this today. 75 or 80% of people in poor countries work in agriculture. So if you can move the needle in agriculture, you can get people producing more efficiently, producing larger volumes, you'll create increased incomes that spread across the vast majority of the population. So that's where you start. And then the second policy area that I wrote about in How Asia Works is manufacturing. And I explained that it's really only manufacturing that can take people out of the rural economy into the modern, if you like, urban economy of industry. And take large numbers of people and do it in a cost-efficient way, because manufacturing is an activity where people can generally learn on the job. I mean, you start, everyone gets into manufacturing with garmenting and then more vertically integrated textiles, and people come and start doing jobs that they can learn to do in a few weeks, and they can upgrade their skills on the job. It's not like services, where for value-added services, it's almost always the case that you've got to have quite a lot of education before you can do the job. So if you're going to be a sound engineer or a software writer or something like this, you can't turn up at a firm that writes software and start doing, you know, one line on day one and then, you know, you've got to be able to do it. It's a skill that you've got to have before you can do the job. So it's fundamentally different to manufacturing. And for that reason, manufacturing has always been extremely important to developing countries. And also, manufactured goods are much more readily traded in the world. You know, manufacturers still make up about 3/4 of all the goods and services traded in the world. So services are just about 1/4. Although now we're starting to trade some more services, because with broadband internet, you can do more things remotely. But nonetheless, services remain a fraction of international trade in manufacturers. So agriculture, and then manufacturing. And then the final area that I wrote about is finance, and how developing country governments that are effective in creating high sustained rates of growth, how they deal with finance. And here, some of the policies that I highlighted are controversial in the sense that they are different to the policies that are pursued by already rich countries. So, you know, if you take a country like China as an example, China still maintains capital control, so it still controls the flow of capital in and out of its economy. It very closely controls the banking system. There are some quasi-private banks in China, but most of the banks are state-owned. And in fact, they are beginning to regain a bit of market share, having lost a lot of market share. And this allows a government like the government of China to effectively to direct capital where it wants it to go. And so when it has its priorities in agriculture and it has its priorities in manufacturing, it can make sure that the money goes where it wants. And I'm sure you're aware that China has a huge push at the moment to move into new areas of very value-added manufacturing that it hasn't done before, you know, much to the upset of, in particular, the government in Washington DC. And this is, you know, at the heart of some of the strains, the trade strains between the two countries. But developing countries have always tended to do this kind of thing and use various tricks to make the financial system pay its way. An obvious one is that countries like China, or before it, Japan and Taiwan and Korea, pay ungenerous interest rates in the banking system to savers, or somewhat less generous than you would get in a free market economy, and give the banks quite wide margins, which allows them to lend to, in particular, manufacturing activities, where in some cases the loans don't get repaid, but they can compensate because they have good, very good margins. So the profitability allows them to do what the government wants them to do, rather than what banks would do if they were left to their own devices, just to make as much money as possible. So I pointed out that those are the commonalities of the most successful East Asian developing economies.
Well, it's fascinating, just on that last point of the financial sector. So I live in Japan, and I've just been reading through quite an interesting, semi-controversial book, Princes of the Yen, looking at the history of central banking in Japan. And no doubt you would be aware of the history of window guidance and sort of not a planned economy per se, in a sense that actual central planning is taking place, but there is a degree of nudging through the apparatus of the central bank that happened post-war, that certain industries were supported over others. And this kind of feeds back into this export discipline that you write about in How Asia Works, sort of, you know, the famous examples in Japan being things like automobiles, electronics, being supported in that post-war period, not in a direct sense, but sort of in a roundabout way. And it was very interesting to read about the history of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think developed countries always tend to assume that what went on in their past is exactly what goes on today. And of course, that's not true. So, you know, the United States is essentially a free market nation today, but then it is the technological leader of the world in many areas. So competition, open competition, suits the United States very well. But, you know, if you go back to the developmental era of the United States and look at how the U.S. behaved, you'll find that in 1900, the U.S. had the highest average tariff in the world.
Yeah,
it was running an average 40% tariff in 1900 because it was protecting its infant industries against competition, particularly from European manufacturers. So I think, you know, the lesson of development really is that governments and nations do what is appropriate to the stage of development that they are at.
Yeah. Well, it's not a one size fits all. And I think almost you look at, say, the growth of a tree over time, you know, sometimes you do need to put a fence up around it to stop it being grazed by animals. And then once it is big enough, it's able to sort of grow on its own. And I think this was a really interesting takeaway. Again, my my memories of reading how Asia works in a cafe in Thailand when I was there, and seeing, in a sense, Thailand is within Asia. It's seen as a middle power, yet still a lot of the manufacturing taking place there is set up by overseas corporations. There was a real estate bubble in 1997, this Asian financial crisis, which was mixed all up together. The development of somewhere like Thailand is markedly different from somewhere like Japan or Taiwan, which you write about, and kind of trying to understand how we arrived at that place was certainly very illuminating for me. But now you've spent your career looking at East Asia, which is very interesting, but now Africa. What prompted the move to focus on African development?
Well, in a way, and I mean, here's the name drop. In a way, Bill Gates did, because I after Gates liked the last book, I met him in Seattle, and we talked about East Asia. We mainly talked about China for an hour or so. But at the end of it, he said, you know, what I'd really like to know is what you think about Africa, because that's where I'm spending all my money. And I didn't think anything of this really at the time, because I don't know if I'd been even to sub-Saharan Africa at that point. So I didn't think much of it. But then the Ethiopian government, and shortly after the Rwandan government, said, will you come out and talk to us? And I said, well, it's very kind of you to ask, but there's no point because I don't know anything about Africa. And they said, well, we don't want you to know. You don't need to know anything about Africa. We want to talk to you about East Asia and policy and discuss some of the sort of policy questions that we're confronting at the moment. And I went, and I think in Ethiopia in particular, and this, of course, is before the recent 2-year civil war, but leaving that aside, I was amazed when I went to Ethiopia by how serious people were in government and how well-read they were, and how much they knew about East Asian development. And I came away, and I still think that of people, government people that I've met in any country, anywhere in the world, they were probably the best informed on. You know, almost like academic questions of development. I'm sure you know that the government that came to power in 1991 in Ethiopia fought a war of more than a decade against the Maoist Derg. And because from around July in Ethiopia you get very heavy rains in the summer, there's a fighting season. And then there's when these rains come, you can't really fight because you can't, most parts of the country, you can't move around. And so they used to stop fighting and read books about Korean exports and things.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I mean, indeed, turning our lens to Africa, there are 54 internationally recognized states with about 1.5 billion people in total. And one of the key differences you identify in the book compared to East Asia is that Africa as a continent is a place of much land but low population density, perhaps as the first point of difference from which we can start looking at development. And I thought maybe you could tell me a little bit more about these unique conditions we see within the continent overall. Obviously, it's a very diverse place, but What are the differences that we must look at to start with in terms of the African situation?
Yeah, the demographics is the big difference, and it's one that no one has really focused on really since the 50s and 60s. There was academic work done in the 50s and the 60s because Africa failed to fulfill the expectations really of some development economists after the Second World War when it didn't take off in the way that people thought that it would on the basis of the resources that there are in Africa. And yeah, it didn't happen because there weren't enough Africans is the main reason. The population density has been so low, and that's had a huge limiting effect on what Africa's been able to achieve, because without sufficient population density, you don't have markets. Markets are critical for everything, but markets begin by being critical for agriculture. I mean, you need cities that provide a lot of reliable, sustained demand for agricultural surplus from surrounding areas. And we're only beginning to see this in Africa now. So we didn't have that. I mean, the reasons historically were that Africa had this extraordinary disease burden above all. It has diseases like sleeping sickness, which just aren't present anywhere else in the world. It has malaria, which is present in other parts of the world, but African malaria is more aggressive, and African mosquitoes are particularly fond of biting human beings rather than animals. And all sorts of other, you know, hookworms and, you know, diseases that still affect hundreds of millions of people. So all this contributed to this very low population density. And as historically did one, in particular, one animal, which is not the animal that people would normally think of. They probably think of sort of lions attacking people. But the problem that caused the biggest limitation to population growth in Africa historically was the elephant, because elephants will eat pretty much anything that human beings want to grow to eat. And if you go back to 1800, there were 200 million elephants in Africa. And unless you've got big guns, you can't do anything to, you can't scare off an elephant. If they want to eat your field of crops, they will eat your
fence. Won't stop them either, right?
Nothing will stop them.
Well, it's interesting because the disease burden you mentioned as well, not just for people, but also for livestock, you know, the rinderpest, the tsetse fly, these various diseases that made it incredibly inhospitable for cattle and you know, these domesticated animals to be productive, and also low quality soils in a lot of cases, the ability to grow grass or feed for animals maybe meant that, and perhaps growing practices as well, and were in a sense led to maybe more grazing broadly, moving from place to place once soils get depleted, etc. So there's kind of less intensity. And what strikes me about this is actually a criticism of American cities that is really interesting from an urban planning perspective, is that a kilometer of road, how many ratepayers are paying for that? Because when it's a diverse, spread out population, it's actually, you know, it's not paying for itself. Whereas if you have a very dense, you know, somewhere like Tokyo, a Japanese city, an Asian city, you know, there's a lot more ratepayers, there's a lot more taxpayers per kilometer who are actually contributing to that piece of infrastructure. So this low density, the economics can be quite clearly outlined there, it seems.
Exactly. I mean, when you start to look, you realize that you need population density for all kinds of reasons. I mean, you say, you know, there that often African soils are lower quality, but actually you can work on soil quality and you can work organic material into the soil, but you need a lot of labor to do it. You can't do it with big machines, you know. So if you're in East Asia and you've got plenty of people, you can upgrade soil quality in areas where it's not very good. Africa just hasn't had that possibility. And then, as you say, with infrastructure, the unit costs of infrastructure depend fundamentally on the density of population and number of people that you've got. And I, you know, in the Africa book, I give some examples to help people to understand this. So obviously I'm British, so in one example I give is how the UK works fiscally. So the UK is divided into regions by the Office of National Statistics. And in the UK, we have only two areas that produce a fiscal surplus in the whole country. One is London and one is the southeast. And unsurprisingly, these are the two most densely populated parts of the country. Everywhere else produces a fiscal deficit. So in some sense, they're kind of sponging off the southeast and London in tax terms. And if you look at just London accounts for 70% of the UK's, the whole of the UK's fiscal surplus. Now, overall, there's a fiscal deficit because the deficits are bigger than the surplus, but two regions produce this. And you know, when you can look, you can dig down into this and look further. I mean, I don't know if you've been in London recently, but last few years there was a new tube line open called the Elizabeth Line, and it's a fantastic tube line. It cost nearly £30 billion. It was the biggest infrastructure project in Europe. But it was affordable for London because 1.5 million people live within a 5-minute walk of a station on that line. Nowhere else, even in other cities, no other city could pay for that tube line. But once you've got the density of population, you can do it. So for all sorts of reasons, population density is absolutely critical to economic development. And we don't tend to think like this. And part of the reason is because for the last 250 years, we've all had this Malthusian obsession that it's going to be overpopulation that is going to bring the world to an end, you know, that we'll breed ourselves into extinction. I mean, it's turning out to be actually the opposite of reality, because I'm sure you're aware that around the world, the great challenge now is depopulation. It won't be many more years before population is falling in the majority of the world's countries. And Africa is the one place on the planet where population is still rising rapidly. And it needs to rise rapidly for another 70 years to the end of this century in order for Africa to have what one might call a normalized population density by global standards. I mean, in 2030, at the end of this decade, the population density of Africa will only be what it was in Asia in 1960. Yeah. So it will only get to where Asia was at the beginning of development at the end of this decade.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. I mean, as I mentioned, I live in Japan, and the population in absolute terms is decreasing here. Yeah. I think over 500,000, half a million people less than last year, according to the statistics. And this is fascinating because the opposite of that, coming back to the density question, you know, just near my house, there's fields which are perhaps 1 hectare or even less than a hectare, and yet they are bulging with all sorts of fruit and things being grown. And it's incredibly manicured and looked after and highly productive land. And so it's a very interesting situation, right? And so we've got this this history of low density, though, and it's got an impact, though, because what that meant, as you write, quote, the impact of sparse population was that where political power did develop, it focused not on the control of land, but on control of people and their domesticated animals. People were always the most scarce resource in Africa. And this presented some interesting outcomes when the colonial project began to take place. Maps were drawn where previously there were no maps. There was a demarcation of territories in a very European fashion. And this led to a lot of challenges, right? So maybe you could elaborate more on sort of that role of low population density in the beginning with colonialism.
Yeah. Well, I think the most obvious manifestation, as you said, is that in Africa, people didn't try to control land. They tried to control people. And what that meant historically, long before outsiders came to engage in slavery in Africa, Africans themselves were enslaving other African people. So that had a long history. What really happened then with the arrival of, on the one hand, Arabs from the Middle East and Europeans, was that they really industrialized slavery. So a lot of traditional slavery within Africa, which was very widespread, tended to be what anthropologists describe as open systems, which meant that, in the second or third generation, slaves would often become part of the community that had enslaved them, whereas slavery run by foreigners was closed slavery systems, as they're called, and people who were enslaved remained slaves, and so did their kids and their children's children. So again, that all comes out of demographics And really, as a number of academics have observed over the years, there was indigenous slavery before foreigners came for slaves in Africa. But the reason that the export of slaves became such a vast scale, over 20 million people in total, is that the slaves ultimately were worth more in the places that they were taken to, which was Latin America and the Caribbean principally, and then of course to the Middle East and some parts of East Africa, some plantations in East Africa. Yeah, they were more valuable in places with better growing plantation growing conditions, above all for sugar. I mean, sugar was the number one slavery crop. Beyond slavery, the other low demographic density impact, which remains very significant today, is that Africa historically was always a place where if two groups of people fell out, they didn't often end up in conflict, because there was always so much space that they could move to another place and set up without having to have conflict. And this is part of the reason why you ended up with this continent with, you know, well over 1,000 different ethnic groups. You know, whereas in Europe, and you know, the UK is the classic place, right? So the English went and beat up on the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish and dominated these groups, and then everybody had to a significant extent accommodate English culture. You know, so the Scots were nominally still a country, but the Scottish elite still had to you know, meet the expectations of the English court in terms of behavior. In Africa, you just didn't get this, because people could remain ethnically separate identities because there was the space for them to do it. So whereas Europe, you fight over land and the dominant ethnicities force everybody else to acculturate, in Africa, you have this huge number of ethnicities that remain in existence. And today, that this sort of creates the problem that after independence, when states, newly created states, are given their independence, that in many cases these different ethnic groups struggle to reach political accommodations and live together peacefully.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, there's a kind of decentralization that seems to be historically here with these various tribes, and this is perhaps a theme that we can loop back in later on in the conversation. But something I just wanted to mention, just with the effect of low population density, is that we don't see the same formation of governance structures or even things such as modern concepts of money in the same way. In a lot of cases, people existed in lieu of money. You know, this kind of, historical betrothing of people and through marriages and things. I'm sure that existed as well. But even just the slave trade as well that we talked about, that acted in lieu of currency that would otherwise be issued by some kind of central state power through some sort of kingdom. And so the formation of European governance structures over the centuries maybe isn't something that happened in the same capacity in Africa. And then with the colonial project, we saw this low budget colonialism that you write about, where kind of in software terms we'd call it maybe the minimum viable product, you know, the MVP of what you could do to run a country was airdropped in these places. Yet it wasn't fully built out in the same way somewhere like New Zealand, where I'm from, which had a full state built out. It didn't quite happen in the same way, did it?
No, it didn't. And again, it's all the demographics. So there's not enough people. So you don't really have a tax base. So you're not getting an income to pay for a colonial government operation. And if we just, obviously, it wasn't just the UK that was a colonial power in Africa. But if we think of the UK, you know, you have to remember that the UK Treasury was always looking out for to avoid, you know, the next drain on the UK exchequer. So they're always saying, often saying, please, let's not have these colonies because they're just going to cost us money, because most of them did. But But if we have them, you know, don't come to us for money, right? You've got to make it pay its way. And the only way you could make fiscal sense of most African colonies was to bring in European mining companies for a bit of extraction there, some plantation companies, and then to operate the colony as cheaply as possible. And the way to operate a colony as cheaply as possible was to work through the tribal chiefs, or at least the people who you decided were the tribal chiefs. And in many African countries, the colonists actually, you know, would find that there wasn't a big chief in these tribes. And so they would just say, right, well, you're the big chief. You know, an example would be in the Igbo in Nigeria, where they didn't have chiefs. So the Brits said, right, well, we'll create these people called warrant chiefs. And the warrant was a piece of paper that said that you're the chief. And you then you go off and start bossing people around. And you back them up in the sense that you say, well, if you have trouble, you can call us and we'll send some troops. And we want you to do principally two things: collect us some tax and get us some labor, you know, some forced labor. After the 1830s, not, you know, it wouldn't be officially slaves, but near enough slaves, because you need labor to sort of build roads and do all the things that governments want to do. So it was very, very limited governance. It embedded and not, you know, these tribal leaders in traditional forms of rule that were really dreamt up by colonial leaders rather than being an accurate representation of how life went on before the Europeans turned up. And of course, that was a very poor set of cards for these countries to be holding in the late 50s and 60s after independence. I mean, they didn't have experience of being nations. They didn't have experience of projecting power really beyond capital cities. I mean, most colonial governments, like the African governments that preceded them, where states had developed a bit, were basically just the capital city and the area immediately surrounding it. And then beyond that, you just had a list of chiefs who were supposed to bring you tax and workers.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. I mean, you mentioned Nigeria. I mean, the other one that comes to mind is Rwanda, with the maybe you can tell us a bit about that. But the anointing of a certain tribe as superior over another, and that eventually also causing issues, right?
Yeah, I mean, Rwanda was quite extreme in that you had two ethnic groups. I mean, it's not even clear that they are really distinct ethnically, but they were deemed to be distinct, the Tutsi and the Hutu. And the Tutsi had always operated as a controlling, you know, minority controlling aristocracy of 10 to 15% of the population. And when the Belgians came in, they decided that absolutely the Tutsi were different, and you know, presented this Hamitic thesis, which from the Bible is one of the sons of Noah who upsets Noah and then is turned black. So they decided that the Tutsis were not like proper black Africans; they were really black Caucasians. But you know, in practical terms, the kind of thing that they did, which really embedded the division in Rwandan society, is they gave everybody an identity card which identified them as Tutsi or Hutu. And this isn't unique to Rwanda, where this division ends up in a number of different cases of genocide. But obviously the best known one is the 94 one, where about 800,000 people died. But it was a case in a significant number of African countries that people ended up with ID cards with ethnicity on it. I mean, Ethiopia is another case. It's changed it changed actually just before the Civil War. But, you can imagine the potential for strife and conflict that is created when you go round with an ID card that says.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, the other classic example is South Africa, where, internal travel was restricted, living arrangements and where you could live, where you could go were restricted based on, in that sense, a racial project. But coming back to the economic base and this kind of formation of states, one of the innovations which I learned about reading your book was the Hutt tax, and how that effectively was an attempt by colonial governments to bring these African natives into the economic system of the state, where you had to pay tax for the hut and the dwelling that you were in, as an attempt perhaps to bootstrap the monetary base of the colonial government. But as you mentioned as well, there's a drain, which is interesting. I don't know if I picked up on that. A net drain from somewhere like the UK, from these colonies. It seems like, economics plays a real critical role here in what exactly gets funded and what sorts of things can be built by the state. And so that then flows down into infrastructure, education, schools, all of that other stuff that is traditionally provided by the state. So there's kind of a bigger question here about, like, how do you bootstrap a state, in a sense?
Yeah, and that's extremely difficult when you don't have the population density. And as you say, the hut taxes that were introduced principally by the British, but not only by the British, were an effort to respond to this, because what you got with very, very low population density in Africa and almost no infrastructure, you just got this incredibly low economic equilibrium where people had as much land as they wanted. If your land became less productive, you could move to new land. If the nutrients on your land were consumed, you moved to some more land, often just with slash and burn agriculture. And of course, the Brits and everybody else turned up and thought, this, what are we going to do? We need labor to do stuff. And so hut taxes that were conceptualized because they were payable in cash. So, I think initially they thought, well, we can let people pay with grain or other agricultural produce. But then they realized, no, we don't want to do that because they just will pay us with grain and we won't get any labor. So if they're payable in cash, nobody has any cash. Right, but we can issue cash, but you can only earn cash by doing jobs. Mostly, the vast majority of the jobs were for colonial governments. So if they wanted a road built or something like that, you do that for 2 months, you get the cash, and then you can pay your hut tax.
Yeah, so it's kind of almost a bit of a charterist kind of approach to demanding payment in the currency, and therefore people have to then find their way into that formal economy and earning that money issued by the state. So that's really interesting. So we've got this, there's various situations, and perhaps some of it seems perhaps negative towards development. But what I do want to move into then is talking about the success stories, because you do identify four case studies in the book of countries that have done relatively well in this development project, including Botswana, Mauritius, Ethiopia, and Rwanda, each perhaps not following the outline of what worked for Asia, but certainly have found parts that have worked and have taken them in a good way. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about those and what worked well and maybe what didn't work so well in these four case studies that you highlighted.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of variation. Botswana, which is a large country and this landlocked country in the south of Africa, most of the money that paid for Botswana's development came from a small number of extremely large diamond mines. However, the Botswana government was very effective in managing that resource. And it was also, in its way, effective in agriculture. The government there did not to anything really effective for smallholder agriculture. But what it did do is it supported the development of large-scale cattle herding, owned where the cattle are owned by largely by the Botswana aristocracy, and they negotiated very good deals with the EU and other export recipients for that, and then took money from these diamond mines, which were operated by De Beers, but then in joint ventures that moved quite quickly to 50-50 joint ventures, took that money and invested it, I would say, more or less in the way that the World Bank would have recommended them to invest it. I mean, they built roads, they built hospitals, and they built schools. They didn't run any effective industrial policy to develop manufacturing, but they built an effective civil service, and they ran a very clean government. The problem they face now is that we have, I mean, they're being technologically disrupted in the sense that we have the development now of synthetic diamonds, which are creating a lot of concern about where the market for real diamonds is going to go. And just generally, the diamond market has not been good. And they've ended up as an incredibly unequal society, because if you promote large-scale cattle herding and then you have, you know, an elite that works for government and an elite that works managing these diamond mines, you get to where they are in terms of having, you know, a population that is 20% very comfortable and 80% very uncomfortable. I mean, they are one of the most unequal societies on Earth. But nonetheless, I mean, they you know, they had this resource with the diamonds, and they managed it very well. And they built a non-racial, as they always called it, a non-racial society as a South African neighbor. And they managed all of that extremely well too, through the apartheid era. Mauritius then was the country which was became the first one really to sort of replicate the Asian model. They were an island of sugar farming run by sugar oligarchs. They thought in the beginning, well, maybe we need to do a land reform and chop up these sugar estates and just give them to smallholders. But they decided in the end, no, we will give more support and better terms, better refining terms to smallholders. And what we'll do instead is we will tax these sugar oligarchs very heavily, and we will create various fiscal incentives for them to go into manufacturing. So Mauritius was the first African country that had a clear manufacturing plan. And in a decade from the early 70s, they took unemployment in Mauritius from about 25% to close to zero, because they developed a globally very competitive garmenting sector, which subsequently vertically integrated. I mean, I'm sure you know the lowest value-added bits is just sewing clothes together. When it becomes more value-added and when you can respond more quickly to customer demands is when you're also making the fabric that you're using. So today, they have large companies that are fully vertically integrated. And then they developed their services pretty effectively, because they were able to do various offshore things. The finance they did pretty similarly to East Asian countries. And I mean, they had one or two ethnically Chinese people in Mauritius who were important in creating links with Taiwan and Hong Kong, and helping government to sort of understood why things were done in a certain way.
Yeah, it's just pulling on that thread. Just the another piece of that is the role of Indians and Chinese in Africa, which again, with a tribal culture, with the African continent, in many cases this was suppressed. But these people have also proven to be key in connecting the African market with Asia and other parts of the world. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about that aspect.
Yeah, it's mainly Indian. Well, also some Pakistani. and some very small numbers of Chinese, then also kind of odd ethnic groups like Lebanese and Greeks. And these are communities who found like economic space, if you like, in the colonial era. So the, you know, the colonists, like the Brits, would come and they would do banking and they would do large scale mining investments and they would do plantations. But in among all this, there were all kinds of opportunities, and particularly opportunities to do commercial activities in between the colonial and the local populations. And what you've got to remember in Africa is that, unlike East Asia, including Southeast Asia, after the First World War, in East Asia, Southeast Asia, after the First World War, you start to have local entrepreneurs who get significant amounts of capital. They tend to do quite sort of basic manufacturing business, but then they sort of move into a bit of banking and things. And that's the beginning of all these people who will dominate East Asian economies in the post-independence era. In Africa, you just don't, you don't get that. It's just on a completely different human resources level. And again, the main reason, demographics, governments don't have tax. So the biggest manifestation in many ways of colonial governments not having tax in Africa is that until the 1950s, almost no colonial government operates any schools of any description. Yeah, so the only schools that operate in Africa until the 1950s, the decolonization era, are missionary schools, which are kind of very unpredictably distributed.
Well, and it's fascinating because, yeah, because again, after that decolonization project, a lot of these people who could be valuable on an entrepreneurial level, you know, especially Indians, Pakistanis, were often shunned or excluded from that. And so there was kind of an unfortunate opportunity missed there, right?
Absolutely. So after decolonization, you know, many of these groups were very resented. I mean, the famous one is Asians in Uganda, and Idi Amin kicked them all out. But there was a lot of resentment against Asian, Indian in particular, groups in places like Kenya as well. So that really ran through the 70s and the 80s. But I would say from the 90s onwards that African governments start to realize, well, actually, these people, they are actually Africans. You know, they've been here for one, two, three generations, or in some cases a lot more. And they do contribute and can contribute a lot to local economies. So you see them start to be politically accepted again. And that has gone forward. And at the same time, from, you know, in the last 20 years, you've begun to see the rise of an African entrepreneurial class for the first time. And that, I think, is heavily connected to the implementation of education systems, and then black Africans going offshore to study at university and coming back. There's been a huge change. I mean, it's one of those, as I write in the book, one, you know, there are some successes in Africa that are totally under-recognized or unrecognized by outsiders. And one of them is the speed and success with which African leaders built education systems after independence. I mean, they had nothing. And you take a country like Tanzania, and Tanzania has gone, you know, went in one generation, in 25 years, went from 10% literacy to about 80% literacy. You know, the World Bank actually did, you know, to be fair to them, they did come out and say, no part of the world has constructed an education, an effective education system as fast as Africa.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm coming back to some of these models we can look at that have had differing degrees of success. Of course, Ethiopia, where this kind of conversation started, where you were requested to come and talk with these people. Also a country that was never colonized in the same way as much of the rest of Africa, has always maintained a stronger sense of independence as a nation. What was the situation in Ethiopia? How did that develop?
Well, Ethiopia, of course, as you say, is an empire, but it's a very odd empire because it doesn't have a dominant ethnic group. You know, it's like the UK and the English and the Scots and the Irish and the Welsh are still sort of going at it in 2025. You know, you have the Amhara, who were the traditional imperial group, if you like. You have the Tigrayans, who really led the victory in the war against the Derg, and they see themselves in many respects as the traditional home of Ethiopian identity, because it's the home of Aksum, where the Ark of the Covenant is supposed to be kept in the church there. Then you've got the Oromo, who are the most numerous group and who produced the current prime minister, largely because they hadn't had a prime minister before, so it had to rotate. So you've got an empire without a clearly dominant ethnic group, and that is always a very unstable situation to be in. But after the victory against the Derg in 1991, you had this remarkable leader, Meles Zenawi, who was the guy who led this campaign through the war against the Derg, had led this campaign that, you know, once we win, we need to have a plan, and a good plan, and had, you know, begun to create this remarkably intellectual, revolutionary force, as it was in the beginning. I mean, they cast off the Leninism once they were in power, but they were always a kind of a revolutionary movement. And so they came into power with a plan to begin with agriculture, which they did. And, you know, from the early 90s until today, they quadrupled the output of Ethiopian agriculture based on smallholder farming. They had a very clear plan that they needed to have manufacturing. So they've built a couple of dozen industrial parks, quite a few of which have filled up with Turkish and Indian and Chinese and other firms. They knew that they needed to generate a lot of cheap electricity to offer to industry, that this was a key thing from East Asia. Cheap electricity, cheap, reliable electricity is absolutely fundamental to manufacturing success. So they built all sorts of hydro projects, the biggest of which is the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which the World Bank refused to finance because it's on the Blue Nile, which goes into the White Nile, and then it goes to Egypt, and the Egyptians are absolutely mad about it because they say that the Ethiopians are going to, you know, when there's drought, the Ethiopians will hang on to the water, and then, you know, Egyptians will start. I mean, it's a huge, you know, this huge dam, but it's got surface to air missile batteries around it in case the Egyptians try to destroy it. So they did this, and then with finance, they did the classic East Asian things with finance, by just making finance serve the purposes of development rather than push out consumer finance. And it's all been extremely successful, apart from ended up with the Tigrayans. I mean, I would say the Tigrayans starting, but you can argue it both ways. They ended up with the Tigrayans starting another civil war, which went on for a couple of years. And this has made, you know, and it was absolutely brutal war in which hundreds of thousands of people died, which I describe in some detail in the book. And this has made some people very negative about the outlook for Ethiopia, and all led a lot of people to sort of say, you know, it looked like it was going to be another miracle economy, but it's not now. I'm not so sure, and I remain quite optimistic, not because I'm a huge fan of the current prime minister, but because, in my view, when you put down tracks, policy tracks in development, and people get used to them, even a huge political upsets, even something like a civil war, it's very difficult to push an economy off the tracks once it's running down them. And I think that, you know, the commitment to smallholder agriculture is very much embedded. I think the commitment to manufacturing is there. So we'll see. But I personally continue to feel quite optimistic about Ethiopia.
That's interesting, because I do want to, in a bit, come back to this idea of the importance of democracy in these states with differing cultural demographics, different tribal demographics. But perhaps the next final one, just to wrap up that piece around these success stories, would be Rwanda, and of course Paul Kagame, and his regime there. Yet this big vision of the Singapore of Central Africa. Perhaps you could just say speak a little bit to what you found in Rwanda.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rwanda's a very interesting case. I met Kagame briefly, and I mean, he's not my type of leader, I don't think. You know, I describe him in the book as brutal but developmental, and I think he's got an awful lot to. I mean, I think he's absolutely ruthless, I suppose, is how I describe him. But he is also developmental. He doesn't have the intellectual reach of Meles Zenawi, but he's very focused on getting things done. And the Singapore of Central Africa plan sounds crazy because Singapore is an island, right, in the sea. And Rwanda's bang in the middle of Africa, is totally landlocked. But when you look at it and you talk to people about what they're doing in Rwanda, you begin to realize that it's not actually as crazy as you might think, because the distance to the coast in any direction from Rwanda and the large area around it means that the logistics cost of anything coming in is very, very high. So you can, if you've got the raw material inputs, you can manufacture stuff, Rwanda, and the prices will be competitive, even if you're not hugely efficient. And then, of course, you know what, I mean, Kagame would deny this, but I would say that what Kagame has done with his involvement in the Second Congo War is that he's effectively carved off the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo to be actually his hinterland. And so Rwandans and Rwandan firms can mine goods and they can sell goods into an area that contains, you know, back to demographics, another 30 million people in terms of a market, which is, you know, 2.5 times the size of the Rwandan market. You know, he's also got opportunities in Uganda, in Burundi, which is a much less competently run country. So you kind of become Singapore by virtue of your isolation. You know, all you have to do is be more efficient than the countries that surround you. And Rwanda is certainly doing that. Yeah. And he's doing all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, and he's got a very nice sort of hotel conference center complex, you know, so, and all sorts of people coming in and using this, and they're very good at raising money. I mean, they've raised money for Scandinavia, for a sort of tech hub, all kinds of stuff. And he has, you know, it's a bit like Gaddafi, but better. I mean, he makes extraordinary use of women in his administration. I mean, there are more women than men. They are extremely effective at the public relations that they do, but they don't just do that. I mean, in parliament and in the judiciary, and they're incredibly loyal to him. I mean, Rwanda already ranks, I can't remember, certainly in the top five in the entire world for the empowerment of women when measured by their senior civil service, parliament, judiciary, status.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting story, but I mean, I don't sort of pull punches on Rwanda because I don't think that one should. You know, you have to consider the developmental progress alongside the evidence of what Kagame has been up to in Eastern DRC, how he treats political challengers within Rwanda, the evidence of his involvement in extrajudicial killings in other states around the world. I mean, even in the UK, we've had people put under special protection because they're considered potential hits. Well,
it's interesting because I wanted to pull on that one because, you know, moving to the question of democracy and dictatorships, right? Of course, the analogy with Singapore is, of course, Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew, who is very famous for leading Singapore into its status today, but also, in a sense, could be considered as a figure, very strong. I wouldn't go so far as to call him a dictator, but certainly a strong figure within the Singaporean government who really didn't pull his punches either and was very ruthless in many ways. And so this kind of analogy to Singapore is quite interesting. And then, of course, looking at Taiwan and Korea as well, which for a very long time were totalitarian and dictator states under the Kuomintang in Taiwan and then the various families in South Korea. Both of which, I think it was around about 1987, they started having elections. But there was a long period of a very brutal martial law, repression, all sorts of things. And yet these countries were able to move on from that. And so, I mean, do you see any connections there, perhaps in the role of a strong man in that initial phase before then moving into something a bit more democratic, perhaps?
I think that's how Kagame thinks. I mean, I think après moi le déluge. So it's got to be moi. I mean, I met him at the point where he was still saying that he wasn't going to run for a third term, and then of course he just did get a, and there are funny things that happen. I mean, I think I wrote in the book about the election in which, in some parts of Rwanda, there was so much ballot stuffing. The votes for Kagame were actually like 110% of the population. So I think that is the case. And then the question is, you know, what happens when he goes? I mean, he's not that old. I forget his age now. He's not that old. He seems to be in good physical shape, although he works extraordinarily hard. But that it's the old thing. I mean, the thing I criticize Melezenau in Ethiopia for in the book is too strong a belief that if you just make people rich, the ethnic things will go away. I think, I'm not saying that there's no truth in that, that prosperity can't make ethnic differences less important. But it's a rather sort of Marxist line, that it's all about material well-being. And I don't think it is. And in Rwanda, the reality is that the Tutsis are back in power with Kagame, who's an aristocrat on both sides of his family. And the efforts that Kagame made early in his administration in the late 90s to have Hutu front up in the top positions in government, that's largely over now. Those people have been gotten rid of. So I don't think for a moment that in a situation where 14% of the population is seen to be bossing around 86% of the population, that there isn't still the possibility for very violent ethnic strife. I mean, this isn't to say that there are no Hutu in his administration. There are, but it's just more, self-evidently Tutsi than it was at the beginning.
I think overall, though, I mean, as you do write, quote, the real difference in Africa is that ethnic diversity makes democracy the only viable mechanism to ensure political stability. And this is the you know, end quote. That this is interesting because, you know, again, we look at Japan or Taiwan or South Korea, where there is for the most part, a single language, a major majority of an ethnic group. And so, in a sense, this is playing on hard mode, having to make democracy work amongst various different kinds of people who maybe have different languages, different backgrounds. And perhaps, again, this is where the role of the state is important in terms of defining language, defining cultural values. I mean, this is, you know, nation-building stuff. What is the national values of a country, and what do we in the collective believe in? Again, something interesting to study. How do you bootstrap that? What is the Rwandan identity that can be talked about? What is the Ethiopian identity that can be talked about in the collective? And again, maybe somewhere like Singapore or say even Malaysia can be looked at as a place with a plurality, perhaps problematic in its own ways with the different power given to the different groups in that. But certainly Malaysia and Singapore have a plurality there that has been able to work quite well, it seems.
Singapore's always been very Chinese, hasn't it? So the Malay minority in Singapore, I think, has always felt quite oppressed. But I mean, going back to what you were saying about democracy, I think it's important to recognize in Africa that, yes, democracy is relatively more present in Africa than it was in Asia at the same stage of development. And that is exactly as you say, it is for that reason that democracy tends to be the only system that can take some of the heat out of the ethnic division, because when you do have a dictatorship, and it's a dictatorship from an ethnic group that represents 30% telling the other 70% what to do, it's not like when you have the Communist Party of China as a dictatorship and it's drawn from 95% of the population. Yeah, you know, in a country like China, you've only got 5% in minorities, so that's just a difference in Africa. And then I think the question is, you know, how good will Africa be at containing ethnic difference as population density increases and populations rise? Because people are very much being pushed up against each other now. And if you look at a country like Kenya, you get pretty regular violence there between different ethnic groups, usually over land. Because, you know, again, having talked earlier about a history of low demographic density in parts of Africa, now you're starting to get to quite significant demographic density, and that in among poor people shows up usually more than anything over land issues. And I'm sure, I mean, like, for instance, you will have followed what's been, you know, all the conflict in the Sahel, you know, the south side of the Sahara, which is the Sahel, you know, where essentially you get a bit of grass and the odd tree growing and whatever, and you get nomadic groups going through that area. But with climate change and also with rising population, these groups are increasingly in conflict with settled farmers further south now as they push further south in pursuit of food for their animals.
The other thing I wanted to dive into as well is coming back to this third pillar of the financial economy, a sort of a sense of protectionism around the banking sector and the way money works within a country. And certainly we saw with the decolonization a rapid move towards national currencies, a bootstrapping of central banks in many former African colonies. But yet also today we still see the lingering effects, particularly from the Francophone countries, where you have a colonial Central African colonial franc still in circulation, this relationship to the former colonial powers, and sort of perhaps a problematic relationship to this sort of banking system. So perhaps at a high level, did you find anything interesting or what really stood out to you when you looked at that way the banking system evolved in the post-colonial era?
I think the finance side in Africa is generally quite concerning from a developmental perspective, because there are not many countries like Ethiopia where they've had the domestic wherewithal to decide what they want to do with the banking system and the broader financial system and do it. Most countries have tended to simply follow the advice of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So they've got rid of capital controls, they've privatized banks, the banks have often been privatized to foreign banks. A lot of this happened in the context of structural adjustment programs done by the IMF in the 1980s and the 1990s. You know, so it was done at the time when the IMF was at its kind of ideological extreme, if you like. The IMF today is a much, much less extreme on these questions than it was back in the 90s. And it got large numbers of African countries to make these changes, which has given them banking sectors, which are actually quite profitable because they push out consumer finance, but they don't have capital controls, they don't have development banks, they're not set up to do things that will support the kind of strategies that were used in East Asia, but also that have been used in the most successful African countries, in Ethiopia, in Mauritius and in Botswana.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the image I have that comes to mind is, again, you've got these small plants that are growing, and without a fence around them, they're just going to get grazed. And opening up, removing capital controls, enabling foreign direct investment just like that, and especially this in the 80s and 90s, as you write about with the IMF, it sort of just opens up a market that isn't really ready. And again, if we come back to East Asia and Japan and Taiwan, certainly very closed off for a long time, and protectionist, and really trying to foster that internal capacity before gradually opening up at a later date. And so it seemed as if that project led to perhaps, you know, as you say, this maybe focus on consumer services, yet without an overarching national strategy that's able to back it up. And is there a way out of that? I mean, can you put that genie back in the bottle, do you think?
It's difficult. I mean, it's obviously very difficult to reintroduce capital controls once you've got rid of them. But there, you know, there are possibilities. Rwanda got rid of its capital controls, but as we've said, Rwanda wants to be the Singapore of Central Africa. So Rwanda wants to have an open capital account, so that if, you know, who knows who, someone doing some running a dodgy gold mine in DRC wants to put their money in a Rwandan bank, they can just shift it over from DRC. So to them, it makes sense. But it's striking that Rwanda has retained its development bank and is seeking to expand that and to build its capital base. So, I mean, there are always things that you can do, but more difficult, I think, to reinstitute capital controls once they've gone.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I mean, again, I do feel that there's perhaps a slightly pessimistic tone overall from our conversation so far. And it's such a complex thing, though. I mean, again, we're talking about a continent here, 54 countries, each one with its own kind of story, its own trajectory. Yet we do see these moments of hope, perhaps. Certainly these four case studies that you look at are very interesting. And I wonder whether you're at a high level going through this project of writing a book. I mean, what is your overall sense? What have you come away learning? What has left the most impact on you?
I think the demographic story, because I'd never dealt with sparsely populated countries before. And yeah, so suddenly you realize that you're confronted with a whole new game. So I think that was very interesting. The other thing that interested me was that I thought that it would perhaps be the case in Africa that I would see that there was somehow a different set of policies that were appropriate to rapid accumulation in Africa. So I was surprised to come away with the view that actually what was done in East Asia in terms of agriculture, in terms of manufacturing, in terms of finance, is all pretty much what is also required in Africa and what has been proven to work in the countries that have so far been more successful. So I think, yeah, those would be the two things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you write, to basically sum up what you've observed, quote, Good financial policy is about getting things done, not about ideology. The primary objectives of development at this stage in Africa are to support smallholder farming, to finance infrastructure that supports agriculture and export manufacturing, and to finance industrial projects that raise the technological capacity of the economy and generate export earnings. Sounds a lot like the trajectory of East Asia as well. I mean, there's something in there. I don't want to go so far as to call it historical materialism, a natural course of events, but it seems as if there is a trajectory there that we can, for the most part, paint in broad strokes, that this is the way to move forward. And it's interesting to see the different ways that you can approach that, right? And very different countries, again, from sub-Saharan Africa, you've got the northern countries all the way down to the south. I mean, there's a wide range of countries, yet there's important policy considerations to bring in there. The final thing I just wanted to dive into, I was just conscious of time, Joe, but the hegemonic question. And I think when I reflect back on the writing about East Asia and the role of the United States in all of these countries that were successful, what is it about a country having the interests of the United States aligned with itself? And is that something that you considered with this book?
Well, I mean, I always say that one of the great rules of thumb in development is you never put your finger in the eye of Uncle Sam, because it makes absolutely no sense to do so. It was one of the, it was the great tragedy of Egypt under Nasser, when they did have a very clear developmental plan, and a good plan, really, in the 50s, that Nasser decided that he was more interested in being the king of the Arabs and getting in a fight with the United States. And so that whole project ultimately unraveled. No, I mean, the US is the biggest market in the world, so you're going to, if you're developing, you're going to be seeking to export things. The US is also, I mean, it isn't right now, but it has been the biggest provider of development aid, and hopefully will go back to being that. And
how do you say the relationship with China in that sense, perhaps, as the new hegemon for supporting these African countries?
Yeah, I mean, again, I write not a massive amount, but a fair bit about China in the book. I mean, China's developed on the East Asian model. It's got huge manufacturing capacity. It's now reached the point where it needs new markets for a lot of manufacturing output. And Africa is, I mean, it's looking all over the world, but Africa is perhaps the single biggest long-term new market for China. And China is also, in terms of its own development, it's cut the price of almost everything that it's got involved in by virtue of operating at massive scale. And so it's come to Africa and it's offered, people talk about, well, are they taking kickbacks? Or I'm sure sometimes that people are taking kickbacks, but more important is that China has come to Africa with credit available. It's not cheap credit, but it's available. And offering, roads and hydro dams and bridges and other things and railways and other things that people need at a much lower price than any other contractor in the world is going to offer. So in that respect, China is important. Of course, it's also tending to sort of flood Africa with consumer goods that Africa isn't very well organized to protect itself against, but I don't particularly blame the Chinese for that. That's what we need Africa to get its act together and have a more effective trade policy.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, just on that China note, I mean, the contracting and the building of these roads and infrastructure, in a lot of cases, and I think you do identify one example where just the roading and having that knowledge in the country actually makes a big difference. And when you're kind of paying for that to come in, you again, you're you get the road, but you don't get the expertise or the workers or any of the capital goods that you would get if you build it yourself, you know, by paying someone to do it. Yeah.
But it depends how you do it. I mean, you know, some countries allow the Chinese to come in and even bring Chinese workers and do the whole thing themselves. Other countries will require that it's a joint venture with a local firm, that only local workers are used. Apart from managers, that's more like what Ethiopia does, or if you look at Rwanda. I mean, Rwandan firms that are government and military linked now have learned themselves to build roads pretty successfully, and in part they've done that from working with Chinese firms in the past. So, I mean, again, I would tend to say that you'll see a lot of variation, and much of the variation is accounted for the nature of the African government you're dealing with.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, yeah, certainly a bit of knowledge transfer can help, you know, people learning what's going on. But look, it's all very fascinating. And I think, I mean, you do, I think, conclude the book on a positive note, and off the back of these case studies, you know, there is these a sense that there is opportunity here, that this is the world's last great frontier, and that, again, looking at Asia in the 1950s, you know, it was maybe a very interesting and opportune time to be doing something. Is that perhaps the case for Africa in the 2020s and the 2030s?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I do feel quite optimistic, and I think that there's some solid evidence to support that. I mean, Africa now has the fastest rate of agricultural growth in the world, about 4.5%. You know, this reflects demographics, right? You've got all these cities now all over Africa. I mean, 100 years ago, the biggest African cities had 20 or 30,000 people in them. Now they've got, you know, 20 million in a city like Lagos. So this creates huge demand. We're seeing it most clearly in agriculture. There's massive amounts of processing that are going on around agriculture. So agriculture used to produce raw food, and people used to buy raw food. Now people buy processed food all over Africa. It varies a lot because it depends on local tastes, you know. But in Ethiopia, where people used to buy teff flour and make injera, the pancakes that are the basis of a lot of Ethiopian food, now you'll buy injera that's been done for you. Or in Nigeria, you buy all kinds of, you know, like Nigerian ready meals. They don't look like what we think of as ready meals because they're done to African tastes, but they are ready meals. Or baby food you get. You know, I mean, you didn't used to get processed baby food in Africa. Now you do. So all of this is going on. And some of the companies that make processed agricultural food are becoming quite big already. And some of them are, and the bigger ones are starting to operate across multiple countries. So you get the beginnings of like sort of, you know, intra-Africa multinationals. You know, they won't be in 54 countries, but they'll be, there's a good number that are in 5 or 10 countries, and they're growing like that. And then, of course, they get more cash, and when you get cash, you see other opportunities outside of what you do, and you think, oh, let's have a go at like that. I mean, like in Tanzania, there's a big the biggest agricultural processing and milling business in Tanzania is now in everything from like soccer to TV stations. So, you know, the kind of modernization of the economy in Africa, it may be that it grows out of agriculture to an even more significant extent than was the case in East Asia. But I mean, as I've written in the How Asia Works book, I mean, it was extraordinary how many big companies grew out of village businesses. You know, I mean, something like Honda, right, was, you know, your own
workshop somewhere, yeah.
It was like making 50cc engines to put on bicycles to convert them to sort of jury-rigged motorbikes, or like Great Wall, which is today the biggest producer of four-wheel drive vehicles in China. That was an agricultural machinery repair business in a village.
Yeah. You know, it's all very fascinating. And certainly the book, How Africa Works, coming out early next year, I believe, right?
It's coming out in January, yeah.
Yeah. I certainly can recommend it to everyone who's interested in development and the development and the future of Africa. I certainly found it to be riveting to read through it. And I'd just like to finish here with a quote on Africa. For us outside of Africa, if you live outside Africa, whether in the Americas, Europe, or Asia, Africa is going to be a bigger part of your life. In trade, investment, tourism, literature, and music, African integration into the world system is beginning in a way it did for Asia half a century ago. Is there anywhere you want to send the listeners, Joe?
Well, no, I mean, I have a blog, but I haven't been putting anything on it for ages.
You've been busy writing a book.
When this book comes out, I will.
Yeah. No, that's all good. And is there anything next? I mean, you've got the book launch coming up early next year, but what else is on your radar?
I'm contemplating writing a developmental history of the UK because I've never written anything about my own country.
That would be fascinating. That's you got somewhere like Manchester, the world's first industrial city. It could be an interesting piece of storytelling, I think.
Yeah, I think. I mean, national decline is the subject du jour in this country. So it seems like a timely thing.
Well, look, there was a few other things I was interested in, but just conscious of time, Joe, we might wrap it up there. Very fascinating. I mean, yeah, certainly can recommend the book to everyone. But yeah, thank you so much for your time, and I might leave it there.
Thank you, Cody. All right.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.